Welcome to the PeaceWorks Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Moles. I'm a pastor and biblical counselor who helps churches and families confront the evil of domestic violence and promote healthy, God-honoring relationships. And welcome back to the PeaceWorks Podcast, everyone. On today's episode, we're going to talk about church-based accountability. But before we jump into that discussion, I would like to remind you about PeaceWorks University. You know, PeaceWorks University is our online membership community. It's really the best next step for those of you who are learning through the PeaceWorks podcast. PeaceWorks University takes similar content, but it's more organized. It involves experts in the field and other resources that can help you grow in the area of domestic violence intervention and prevention from a gospel-centered perspective. So if you'd like to learn more about PeaceWorks University, please visit chrismoles.org. We'd love to have you be part of our membership community. So today I've got a question about church-based accountability, but before I jump into the question, it struck me that for some folks, that might even be an odd topic. Like, why would the church even be involved in accountability, especially with a perpetrator of abuse? In fact, I hear this quite a bit, and I'll give you some rationale for why this is important, but the reason the question comes up, and maybe some of you listening in are experiencing some of this turmoil, the reason why the question comes up is the thought of the church taking the lead on accountability seems irresponsible or dangerous. Shouldn't the courts and law enforcement, shouldn't the civil authorities take the lead on this? And the best answer to that is it depends. Yes, if there's criminality, if there is an event that is criminal and has been investigated and pursued by law enforcement, then absolutely. In fact, we are big proponents of criminal responses, but there are some caveats there. Number one, most domestic abuse is not criminal. Quite frankly, most aspects of abusive, coercive, controlling, manipulative behavior fall outside of the convictable forms of abuse that you might find in the code. And most perpetrators are very skilled at dancing the fine line between that which is socially, civilly, and criminally tolerable and that which is illegal. So that's the first hurdle, is that not all abuse is criminal. And so we cannot simply hope or rely on the civil authorities to provide accountability, because in many cases, they're not positioned to do that. Two, sometimes victims are not prepared to pursue civil or criminal means against their partner for safety reasons. And so in the area of reporting even, we would encourage many of the folks that we train that if you witness abuse, if you witness physical violence, then we would encourage you to report. But if you're receiving a disclosure from an individual who's an adult, who has what we would consider agency, people that whom which you're not a mandated reporter, your best way to serve them may be to simply listen and provide resources and services. Reporting may put them in further danger. And that's why working with advocates and trained victim support would be tremendously helpful in your church. So I bring all that up to say aspects of emotional abuse and psychological abuse and even long-standing coercion, threat, fear that doesn't fall within the category of the legal code will not see civil or criminal responses. They won't see law enforcement responses. However, the church can be engaged when we're dealing with sin that is being perpetrated against another believer. And in particular, domestic abuse is a very specific, hardened form of sin that the church should and can, quite frankly, be engaged in. So there are instances in which the church becomes either the primary source of accountability for the perpetrator, or they become a secondary source. So the primary source would mean no other civil authorities are involved. There's not a protection order. There hasn't been a sentencing order related to criminality. The church is coming alongside a hurting individual to provide safety and sanity in an area and a time when law enforcement and the courts are not prepared or able to do so. Secondary assistance and accountability can and should occur within the church in the presence of those things. So an individual has been convicted, has been sentenced, or has been served a civil order of protection, then the church can and should come alongside to provide added layers of accountability. I've heard of some churches who send elders along with a perpetrator to his mandated meetings, his batter intervention meetings, to learn alongside of him, to hear what he's learning and to help him to stay accountable, setting boundaries, looking at court orders such as no contact orders, and arranging how individuals will receive services from the church and how individuals will respect boundaries within the place of worship. Those are all aspects that the church can play a part in, as well as discipleship and confrontational ministry. Now, unfortunately, many churches run into scenarios untrained, and I think that's where we see a lot of individuals providing comfort to the perpetrator because they can somehow relate to his arrest or his displacement from the home, as opposed to providing continued accountability and protecting the victim. That's kind of where today's question's coming from. So I wanted to start by just kind of laying out that, yes, church-based accountability happens. Church-based accountability is not a bad thing. It's not always automatically a negative. In fact, it's a very positive thing. It should be occurring, whether it is the primary source of accountability or a secondary source of accountability, depending upon the nature, scope of the abuse and the response to the abuse. So the question came in regarding a church who's attempting to hold a perpetrator accountable. And the questioner says, our church has a care team who's attempting to serve an oppressive husband, but he continues to cross boundaries or get up close to the edge of the boundaries that the team has put in place for his wife. Now, the husband always has an explanation for these behaviors, incidents, situations, and our church leadership takes him at his word. The wife is then in a position to have to prove what he did or was trying to do. What an excellent question and a great example of the thoughts and discussions we need to have at the church level about boundaries, in particular about boundaries that are put in place within a case of domestic abuse. And so I love the questioner has kind of laid this out well for us. So let's extrapolate a little bit, and then they do provide a specific example, but I think it'd be helpful if we just wrestle with this first notion for a second. So the church is involved. They're attempting to serve the victim well, and one of the ways they're serving her is by providing him with boundaries, some specific instructions on what the expectations are for him in order for her to feel safe and to see the abuse end. Now, the perspective that we're being given is that he's not blowing by these boundaries, which is so common. This is absolutely a common tactic. And so sometimes what individuals who are kind of trapped in this mindset and worldview will do is they will say, okay, the church care team said I could not do A, B, or C. So if I don't do A, B, or C, like if I rigidly adhere to those three things and I don't do those three things, then I should be given credit. I should be given praise, and I should be considered good, safe. Now, I can park and live within the gray space between A and B, and they shouldn't care about that. Meaning, I'm going to look for ways to snuggle up, to get right up to the edge, to still get my desired outcomes, the things that I want, without crossing their specific boundaries. So that's why when we set boundaries, this is a quick tip, when we set boundaries and concerns for perpetrators, we should do that in the context of expectations, character, and integrity. So I might say something like, let's say the church has multiple worship services and the couple has agreed that he'll attend the 9 a.m. service and she will attend the 11 a.m. service, okay? Assuming that the church has multiple services. I might say something like, okay, so, you know, you've agreed to attend the 9 a.m. service. I think that's really good that you would do that to give your wife and your kids a little bit of space. I just want you to know that This isn't just about clocking in and clocking out, all right? This is about respecting the space that your wife needs to worship properly. So in addition to that, I want to just walk through what that might look like. So let's talk about a typical Sunday and think through how your arrival and your departure from church could be done in such a way that it provides the most respect and space for your wife. A question like that allows me then to dialogue with him to cover all the points of concern that I have. So like, I'm afraid that the church, in this case, for instance, maybe they said something like that. Okay, you're attending the 9 a.m. service. Thank you for agreeing to that. She's going to attend the 11 a.m. service. And then they leave it at that. But he knows where the family parks. And so he parks in the same section of the parking lot. And he dilly-dallies. You know, he says, well, I'm talking with friends. I'm trying to get support. You know, so-and-so was willing to pray with me after the service. And I didn't intend to be walking out of the building as my family was walking in. But that's what happened. And so I may want to have that open discussion with, let's really think about how we can live and exist in the best way possible to show space and respect. That way, when we come up against a rub, like the parking space analogy that I just used, I could say, you know where your family parks, and you chose to park in the same section. Now, you're telling me you didn't intend to run into them, but you put yourself in a position where that's possible. So I'm having a hard time, you know, seeing that as innocent. It's at the very best, it's kind of foolish. So I would hope that you would be more thoughtful in the future. Let's take some time to think through that. And many of you hopefully can hear the difference in that tone of just here's a boundary and here is a way to wisely use and consider that boundary. I hope that helps. I think sometimes in church accountability, we give people checklists, and checklists are not helpful for real accountability. We need to provide boundaries that allow individuals then to self-reflect, right? And we can work with them on that self-reflection to really get to the heart. What is it that I want? Rather than just, okay, I have disciplined myself for 6 months. Now you guys should get off my back. Instead of, I've been discipled for 6 months in a path of thinking, feeling, and choosing. I hope that helps add some clarity. The example that our questioner gave was the wife believes that her oppressive husband was sitting in his car in the parking lot at her workplace. The church leadership requested that the wife get her coworkers and provide a license plate number to prove it. Now, I think if we were investigating a crime, that would be a reasonable request. But we're not investigating a crime. We're establishing and supporting a boundary. And if she saw her husband at her workplace, that's escalatory behavior. So that would be a discussion with the victim as to next steps. My thought would be that's a scary reality, and I would consider that stalking. I don't think you can come up with a good excuse. I even think my parking lot excuses that I made up were better than this one. This seems like escalatory behavior to me. So I think what the church is wanting is they're wanting proof so that they don't have to do the hard work in the confronting of the partner. And I get that, because if you've worked with abusive individuals, then you know how difficult it is to go off of hearsay or establish something without endangering the victim more by saying, hey, this is what happened. You know, instead you want to ask good questions to get them to kind of out themselves, as it were. But it would help. I'm sure it would help if you had pictures of him sitting there so you could just say, look, we know you were there. But whether you have them or not, the boundaries have been established, and you can continue to confront the individual. He can deny it, but again, my experience, the track record is, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I hear that you're denying being there, but the reality is I don't have the privilege of trusting you. You've shown yourself to be untrustworthy in the way that you've treated your wife, so I have to operate from a place of safety. So that's why I'm confronting you on this. Let's talk about it. And I think the church probably wants ironclad evidence so that they don't have to find themselves in that difficult wrestling match, that verbal jousting back and forth with the partner. However, many times we don't have that. We have what we have. And so I think the church should persist, persevere. And if there are other examples, that would be even better. So I've got this example, and let's say I have another example, and let's say I have a third example of just rubbing up against those boundaries, then I have every right as a person holding another person accountable to say, this is not how this works. Like, you have to understand, this is not why we established this. We didn't establish this to give you guardrails or bumper rails to continue to abuse and threaten and frighten your partner. We gave you these to give her time to feel safe and you time to change. And this type of behavior is evidencing that you don't desire to change. You just want to find new ways to harm and terrorize your partner. The questioner goes on to say, why is the husband given the benefit of the doubt? Well, I'm not sure that he is. Maybe he is in your case. I was assuming that the church just didn't want to go in empty-handed, but maybe he is given the benefit of the doubt. We talk about this quite a bit with Proverbs 18:17. I've heard this used so many times to say, you know, that you can't take sides in an abuse case, you know, that one seems right until they're cross-examined. And I'm like, that's really not the purpose of the passage. Of course, it's wisdom literature. But then the next is, if you still don't know who's telling the truth, verse 18 says to cast lots. And so we're not rolling the dice to find out who's telling the truth, but we are trusting God with the outcome of the conflict. And certainly casting lots was a tool that was used to put more pressure on the privileged and those who had an advantage. They had more to lose in a court-based situation, more to lose in a game of chance than by settling out of court through negotiation. So the casting of lots actually protected the vulnerable far more than it did the privileged. And it put the pressure on the person in power to compromise. And I think that's true in cases of abuse, is the pressure shouldn't be placed on the victim at this point. It should be placed again on the perpetrator. So church-based accountability can do that, but we have to be persistent in our goals. Number one, to glorify and honor God. Number two is the safety and sanity of the victim. And number three is the discipleship and development of the perpetrator. And boundaries, again, are tools that we can use to provide for safety and to help sharpen, not simply checklists or guardrails, right? Then we run this risk of developing this Pharisaical abuser who does everything right, right? The rich young ruler type of person who's like, well, I've done this since you guys started this process. I've done everything you've asked me to do, right? I've dotted every I, I've crossed every T, I've done every little thing that you've asked me to do, and I've done it specifically. Whereas we have not given him a clear instruction on self-reflection and things happening at the level of heart. Yes, you walked the line. Yes, you towed the barge. Yes, you did the specific things we asked, but your attitude, your demeanor, and your choices surrounding those boundaries show us that you had no intention on changing. But instead, your desire was simply to follow our system until you could get to the end, until you could get back to where you wanted. The stalking behavior, the manipulative behavior, the coercive behavior are all more indications that there's something deeper going on in your heart. And there's no list of rules that's ever going to change that. I can't manage you into repentance. In fact, there's nothing that I can do or any accountability team can do to make someone repent. I used to use this phrase quite often when I taught, the little pithy statement, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, but you can feed him crackers. I've heard people say you can feed him salt. I think crackers is a funnier word. But the idea is, really, when it comes to perpetrator work, all we can do is attempt to make men thirsty for something different. And boundaries alone, consequences alone, don't do that. Consequences combined with self-reflection, with gospel discussions, with real-life scenarios, with extrapolating thoughts and feelings and choices, boundaries then can be helpful tools. But boundaries alone, while providing safety for the victim, which is one of our major goals, boundaries alone do not compel a perpetrator to change, no more than consequences do. Consequences can change behavior, but not the heart. And where we're going is we want to see heart change. Now, that doesn't always happen. So I think the church has two options here moving forward for our questioner. Option number one is they can begin to dig down deeper and begin to ask hard questions and to be a little bit more passionate about pursuing his soul as opposed to his conformity. So really confronting these tertiary, you know, secondary behaviors that are clearly violating the spirit of the boundary, the spirit of the law, as it were, right? Hoping to see heart change. Or they can be very blunt that we've tried everything that we know to try. You're obviously not willing to participate, and they can move forward with only protecting the victim and pursuing the next steps of church discipline on the individual as somebody who's unrepentant, because a repentant person pursues change. An unrepentant person will pursue acceptance. They will pursue tolerance. They will pursue the path of least resistance. So my hope is that that helps, that church-based accountability is good. It goes beyond just establishing boundaries, though. So I hope this has been helpful. Thank you guys so much for being part of the PeaceWorks podcast. We're so thankful for everybody who listens week after week after week. And are just praying that this is a helpful tool for you and your community. Thank you once again. Till next time, God bless.